My good people of Andorith, he began in a deep, sincere-sounding voice that boomed into the farthest reaches of the room. Tonight, I ask you to consider the future. The time is overdue for us to have the courage to leave our past favoritism where it belongs, in the past. We must instead think of our future, and the future of our children and grandchildren. He had to pause and nod and smile while the room again roared with applause. Once more he began, bringing the audience to silence. Our future is doomed if we allow naysayers to rule our imagination, instead of allowing the spirit of potential given us by the Creator room to soar. He again waited until the wild clapping died down. Dalton marveled at the sauce Bertrand could whip up on the spot to pour over the meat. We in this room have had thrust upon us the responsibility for all the people of Andorith, not just the fortunate. It is time our culture included all the people of Andorith, not just the fortunate. It is time our laws served all the people of Andorith, not just the few. Dalton shot to his feet to applaud and whistle. Immediately following his lead, everyone else stood as they clapped and cheered. Hildemara, still beaming with a loving grin of wifely devotion and fawning, stood to clap for her husband. When I was young, Bertrand went on in a soft voice after the crowd quieted, I knew the pang of hunger. It was a difficult time in Andorith. My father was without work. I watched my sister cry herself to sleep as hunger gnawed in her belly. I watched my father weep in silence, because he felt the shame of having no work, because he had no skills. He paused to clear his throat. He was a proud man, but that nearly broke his spirit. Dalton idly wondered if Bertrand even had a sister. Today we have proud men, men willing to work, and at the same time, plenty of work that needs to be done. We have several government buildings under construction and more planned. We have roads being built in order to allow for the expansion of trade. We have bridges yet to be built up in the passes over the mountains. Rivers await workers to come build piers to support bridges to those roads and passes. But none of those proud men who are willing to work and who need the work can be employed at any of these jobs or the many other jobs available because they are unskilled, as was my father. Bertrand Chanbor looked out at people waiting in rapt attention to hear his solution. We can provide these proud men with work. As the Minister of Culture, it is my duty to our people to see to it that these men have work so they can provide for their children, who are our future. I asked our brightest minds to come up with a solution, and they have not let me nor the people of Andorith down. I wish I could take credit for this brilliant new statute, but I cannot. These scholarly new proposals were brought to me by people who make me proud to be in office, so that I might help them guide this new law into the light of day. There were those in the past who would use their influence to see such fair ideas die in the dark recesses of hidden rooms. I won't allow such selfish interests to kill the hope for our children's future. Bertrand let a dark scowl descend upon his face, and his scowls could make people pale and tingle with dread. There were those in the past who held the best for their own kind and would allow no others the chance to prove themselves. There was no mistaking the illusion. Time meant nothing in healing the wounds inflicted by the Haken overlords. Those wounds would always be open and raw. It served to keep them so. Bertrand's face relaxed into his familiar, easy smile, by contrast all the more pleasant after the scowl. This new hope is the Winthrop Fair Employment Law. He held out a hand toward Claudine. Lady Winthrop, would you please stand? Blushing, she looked about as people smiled her way. Applause started in, urging her to stand. She looked like a deer caught inside the garden fence at dawn. Hesitantly, she rose to her feet. Good people, it is Lady Winthrop's husband, Edwin, who is the sponsor of the new law. And, as many of you know, Lady Winthrop is his able assistant in his job as Burgess. I have no doubt that Lady Winthrop played a critical role in her husband's new law. Edwin is away on business, but I would like to applaud her fine work in this, and hope she relays our appreciation to Edwin when he returns. Along with Bertrand, the room applauded and cheered her and her absent husband. Claudine, her face red, smiled cautiously to the adoration. Dalton noticed that the directors, not knowing what the law was about, were polite but reserved in their congratulations, with people leaning toward her, touching her to get her attention and offering words of appreciation. It was a time before everyone returned to their seats to hear the nature of the law. "The Winthrop Fair Employment Law is what its name implies," Bertrand finally explained. "Fair and open, rather than privileged and closed employment. With all the construction of indispensable public projects, we have much work to do in order to serve the needs of the people." The minister swept a look of resolve across the crowd. "But one brotherhood holds itself to outmoded prerogative, thus delaying progress. Don't get me wrong, these men are of high ideals and are hard workers. But the time has come to throw open the doors of this archaic order designed to protect the special few. Henceforth, under the new law, employment shall go to anyone willing to put their back to the work, not just to the closed brotherhood of the Masons Guild." The crowd took a collective gasp. Bertrand gave them no pause. "Worse, because of this shrouded guild, where only a few meet their obscure and needlessly strict requirements, the cost to the people of Andereth for public projects they construct is far and away above what would be the cost were willing workers allowed to work." The minister shook his fist. "We all pay the outrageous cost." Director Linscott was near to purple with contained rage. Bertrand uncurled a finger from his fist and pointed out at the crowd. "The Masons' vast knowledge should be employed, by all means it should. But with this new law, the common man will be employed too, under the supervision of Masons, and the children will not go hungry for their father's want of work." The minister struck a fist to the palm of his other hand to emphasize each point he added. "I call upon the directors of Cultural Amity to show us now by their raised hands their support of putting starving people to work, their support of the government finally being able to complete projects at a fair price by using those willing to work and not just the members of a secret society of Masons who set their own exorbitant rates we all must bear. Their support for the children, their support of the Winthrop Fair Employment Law." Director Linscott shot to his feet. "I protest such a show of hands. We have not yet had time to..." He fell silent when he saw the sovereign lift his hand.
"If the other directors would like to show their support," the sovereign said in a clear voice into the hush, "then the people gathered here should know of it, so that none may bear false witness to the truth of each man's will. There can be no harm in judging the sentiment of the directors while they are all here. A show of hands is not a final word, and so does not close the matter to debate before it becomes law."
The sovereign's impatience had just unwittingly saved the minister the task of forcing a vote. Though it was true that a show of hands here would not make the law final, in this case, such a schism among the guilds and professions would ensure it did. Dalton did not have to wait for the other directors to show their hands. There was no doubt in his mind. The law the minister had announced was a death sentence to a guild, and the minister had just let them all see the glint off the executioner's axe. Though they would not know why, the directors would know one of their number had been singled out. While only four of the directors were guild masters, the others were no less assailable. The moneylenders might have their allowed interest lowered or even outlawed. The merchants, their trade preferences and routes changed. The solicitors and barristers could have their charges set by law at a rate even a beggar could afford. No profession was safe from some new law should they displease the minister. If the other directors did not support the minister in this, that blade might be turned on their guild or profession. The minister had called for a public showing of their hands rather than a closed-door vote, the implication being that the axe would not swing in their direction if they went along. Claudine sank into her chair. She, too, knew what this meant. Men were formally forbidden work at the trade of Mason unless they were members of the Masons Guild. The guild set training, standards, and rates, governed disputes, assigned workers to various jobs as needed, looked after members injured or sick, and helped widows of men killed on the job. With unskilled workers allowed to work as Masons, guild members would lose their skilled wages. it would destroy the Masons Guild. For Linscott, it would mean the end of his career. For the loss of the protection of Guild law while under his watch as a director, the Masons would doubtless expel him within a day. The unskilled would now work. Linscott would be an outcast. Of course, the land's projects would, in the end, cost more. Unskilled workers were, after all, unskilled. A man who was expensive but knew his job in the end cost less than the finished job was sound. A director lifted his hand, showing his informal, but for all practical purposes, final support for the new law. The others watched that hand go up, as if seeing an arrow fly to a man's chest to pierce his heart. Linscott was that man. None wanted to join his fate. One by one, the other directors' hands began going up until there were 11. Linscott gave Claudine a murderous look before he stalked out of the feast. Claudine's ashen face lowered. Dalton started applauding the directors. It jolted everyone out of the somber drama, and people began joining in. All those around Claudine began congratulating her, telling her what a wonderful thing she and her husband had done for the children of Andereth. Tongues began indignantly scolding the Masons' selfish ways. Soon a line of people wanting to thank her formed to file past and add their names to those on the side of the Minister of Culture and the courage of his fairness. Claudine shook their hands but managed only a pallidest smile. Director Linscott was not likely to ever again wish to listen to anything Claudine Winthrop had to say. Stein glanced over, giving Dalton a cunning smile. Hildemara directed a self-satisfied smirk his way, and her husband clapped Dalton on the back. When everyone had returned to their seats, the harpist poised her hands with fingers spread to pluck a chord, but the sovereign again raised his hand. All eyes went to him as he began to speak.
I believe we should take this opportunity before the next course to hear what the gentleman from afar has to say to us.
No doubt the sovereign was having trouble staying awake, and before he fell asleep he wanted to hear Stein speak. The minister stood to once again address the room.
Good people, as you may know, a war is spreading. Each side has arguments as to why we should join with them. Andereth wants only peace. We have no desire to see our young men and women bleed in a foreign struggle. Our land is unique in being protected by the Dominie Dirch, so we have no need to fear violence visiting us. But there are other considerations, not the least of which is trade with the world beyond our borders. We intend to hear what the Lord Rawl of Dahara and Mother Confessor have to say. They are pledged to wed, as you have all no doubt heard from the diplomats returning from Adendril. This will join Dahara with the Midlands to create a formidable force. We await listening respectfully to their words. But tonight, we are going to hear what the Imperial Order wishes us to know. The Emperor Jagang has sent a representative from the Old World beyond the Valley of the Lost, which has now, for the first time in thousands of years, been opened for passage. Bertrand held out a hand. May I introduce the Emperor's spokesman, Master Stein?
People applauded politely, but it trailed off as Stein rose up. He was an imposing, fearsome, and fascinating figure. He hooked his thumbs behind his empty weapon belt.
We are engaged in a struggle for our future, much the same as the struggle you have just witnessed, only on a larger scale.
Stein picked up a small loaf of hard bread. His big hands squeezed until it broke apart.
We, the race of mankind, and that includes the good people of Andereth, are slowly being crushed. We are being held back. We are being suffocated. We are being denied our destiny, denied our future, denied life itself. Just as you have men without work, because a self-interested guild held sway over the lives of others, denying them work and thus food for their children, magic holds sway over all of us.
A hum rose in the room as whispering spread. People were confused and just a little worried. Magic was loathed by some, but respected by many.
Magic decides for you your destiny, Stein went on. Those with magic rule you, though you have not willingly consented to it. They have the power, and they keep you in their grip. Those with magic cast spells to harm those they envy. Those with magic bring harm to innocent people they fear, they dislike, they envy, and simply to keep the masses in check. Those with magic rule you, whether you like it or not. The mind of man could flourish were it not for magic. It is time regular folks decided what will be, without magic holding its shadow over those decisions and your future. Stein lifted his cape out to the side. These are the scalps of the gifted. I killed each myself. I have prevented each of these witches from twisting the lives of normal people. People should fear the Creator, not some sorceress or wizard or witch. We should worship the Creator, none other. Low murmurs of agreement began to stir. The Imperial Order will end magic in this world just as we ended the magic that kept the people of the New and Old World separated for thousands of years. The Order will prevail. Man will decide his own destiny. Even without our help, fewer and fewer gifted are born all the time, as even the Creator, with his nearly infinite patience, tires of their vile ways. The old religion of magic is dying out. The Creator himself has thus given us a sign that the time has come for man to cast magic aside. More rustles of agreement swept through the room. We do not wish to fight the people of Andorith, nor do we wish to force you against your will to take up arms to join us. But we intend to destroy the forces of magic led by the bastard son of Dahara. Any who join him will fall under our blade, just as those with magic, he held out the cape, fell under mine. He slowly swept a finger before the crowd as he held his cape out with his other hand. Just as I killed these gifted witches who came up against me, we will kill any who stand against us. We also have other means beyond the blade to end magic. Just as we brought down the magic separating us, we will bring an end to all magic. The time of man is upon us. The minister casually lifted a hand.
And what is it, then, if not the swords of our powerful army, the Order wishes from us?
Emperor Jagang gives his word that if you do not join with the forces fighting for those with magic, we will not attack you. All we wish is to trade with you, just as you trade with others.
Well, the minister said, playing the part of the skeptic for the benefit of the crowd, we already have arrangements that commit a great deal of our commodities to the Midlands.
Stein smiled. We offer double the highest price anyone else offers to pay.
Sovereign lifted his hand, bringing even the whispering to a halt.
How much of the output of Andorith would you be interested in purchasing?
Stein looked out over the crowd.
All of it. We are a huge force. You need not lift a blade to fight in the war. We will do the fighting. But if you sell us your goods, you will be safe, and your land will become wealthy beyond your hopes and dreams.
The sovereign stood, surveying the room.
Thank you for the Emperor's words, Master Stein. We will want to hear more. For now, your words have given us much to consider.
He swept a hand before the people.
Let the feast resume.
Chapter 23 Fitch's head hurt, something awful. The dawn light hurt his eyes. Despite sucking on a small piece of ginger, he couldn't get the foul, sour taste in the back of his throat to go away. He figured the headache and awful taste was probably from too much of the fine wine and rum he and Morley had treated themselves to. Even so, he was in good spirits and smiled as he scrubbed the crusty pots. Slow as he was moving, trying not to make his head feel any worse, Master Drummond wasn't yelling at him. The big man seemed relieved that the feast was over, and they could go back to their regular cooking chores. The kitchen master had sent him after a number of things, not once calling him Fetch. Fitch heard someone coming his way and looked up to see that it was Master Drummond.
Fitch, dry your hands.
Fitch pulled up his arms and shook off some of the soapy water.
Yes, sir.
He snatched up a nearby towel, as he recalled with acute pleasure the title of Sir being directed to him the night before. Master Drummond wiped his forehead with his own white towel. With the way his head was sweating, he looked like he might have had some drink the night before, too, and might not be feeling his best, either. It had been a tremendous amount of work getting ready for the feast, so Fitch grudgingly guessed that Master Drummond deserved to get drunk, too. At least the man got to be called Sir all the time.
Get yourself up to Master Campbell's office.
Sir?
Master Drummond tucked the white towel behind his belt. The nearby women were watching. Gilly was scowling, no doubt waiting for an opportunity to twist Fitch's ear and scold him for his wicked Haken ways.
Dalton Campbell just sent word that he wants to see you.
I guess he means right now, Fitch, so get to it and see what he needs. Fitch bowed.
Yes, sir, right away.
Before she could give him much of a thought, he cut a wide path around Gilly, keeping out of her reach and disappearing as quickly as possible. This was one task Fitch was only too happy to rush to do, and he didn't want to be snagged by the sour-faced saucer woman. As he took the stairs two at a time, his throbbing head seemed to be only a minor annoyance. By the time he'd reached the third floor, he suddenly felt pretty good. He rushed past the spot where Beata had clouted him, and down the hall just a short ways to the right, where only a week before he'd taken a plate of sliced meat late one evening to Dalton Campbell's office. The door to the outer office stood open. Fitch caught his breath and shuffled in, keeping his head low in a respectful sort of way. He'd only been there that once before, and he wasn't exactly sure how he was supposed to act in the offices of the minister's aide. There were two tables in the room. One had disorderly stacks of papers all over it, along with messenger pouches and sealing wax. The other, dark, shiny table was nearly clean, except for a few books and an unlit lamp. Morning sun streaming in the tall windows provided light aplenty. Along the far wall to the left, opposite the wall with the windows, four young men lounged and chatted on a long padded bench. They were talking about road conditions to outlying towns and cities. They were messengers, a coveted job in the household, so Fitch guessed it seemed a logical enough thing for them to discuss, but he always thought messengers would talk more of the grand things they saw in their job. The four were well-dressed all the same, in the minister's aide's exclusive livery of heavy black boots, dark brown trousers, white shirts with ruffled collars, and sleeved doublets quilted with an interlocking cornucopia design. The edges of the doublets were trimmed with distinctive brown and black braided wheat banding. To Fitch's way of thinking, the outfits made any of the messengers look almost noble, but especially so those messengers belonging to the minister's aide. There were a number of different kinds of messengers in the household, each with its own individual uniform, each working for a specific person or office. Fitch knew of messengers working for the minister, Lady Chanbur, the chamberlain's office, the marshal's office. The sergeant-at-arms had several. There were a number of army messengers working out of the estate, and those who brought messages to the estate lived elsewhere. Even the kitchen had a messenger. From time to time he saw others he didn't recognize. Fitch couldn't understand why they were all needed. He couldn't understand how much messaging a person could possibly need to do. Far and away the largest contingent of messengers, nearly an army's worth, it seemed, belonged to the office of the minister's chief aide, Dalton Campbell. The four men sitting on the padded bench watched him with friendly enough smiles. Two nodded in greeting, something messengers had done before when he came across them. Fitch always thought it odd when they did, because even though they too were Haken, he always figured messengers were better than he, as if, while not Ander, they were some indefinable step above Amir Haken. Fitch nodded in kind to return the greeting. One of the men who had nodded, perhaps a year or two older than Fitch, lifted a thumb toward the room beyond.
"Master Campbell is waiting on you, Fitch. You're to go on in."
Fitch was surprised to be called by name.
"Thank you."
He shambled over to the tall doorway to the inner room and waited at the threshold. He'd been in the outer waiting room before. The interior door had always been closed, and he expected Master Campbell's inner office to be more or less the same, but it was larger and much more grand, with rich-looking blue and gold drapes on the three windows, a wall of fancy oak shelves holding a colorful array of thick books, and in the other corner, several magnificent Ander battle standards. Each long banner was of a yellow background, with red markings along with a bit of blue. The standards were arranged in a display flanked by formidable-looking pole weapons. Dalton Campbell looked up from behind a massive desk of shiny mahogany with curved legs and a scalloped skirt. The top had three inset leather squares, smaller ones to each side, of a large one in the middle, each with a curly design painted in gold around its edges.
"Fitch, there you are, good. Shut the door and come on in, please."
Fitch crossed the big room and stood before the desk when he had done as bidden.
"Yes, sir, you needed something."
Campbell leaned back in his brown leather chair. His princely scabbard and sword stood beside a tufted bench, in their own special holder of hammered silver made to look like a scroll. Lines of writing were engraved on the scroll, but Fitch couldn't read, so he didn't know if they were real words. Tipping his chair back on the two rear legs while he sucked on the end of a glass dipping pen, the minister's aide studied Fitch's face.
You did a good job with Claudine Winthrop.
Thank you, sir. I tried my best to remember everything you told me you wanted me to do and say.
And you did that quite well. Some men would have turned squeamish and failed to do as I instructed. I can always use men who follow orders and remember what I tell them I want done. In fact, I would like to offer you a new position with my office, as a messenger. Fitch stared dumbly. He'd heard the words, but they didn't seem to make any sense to him. Dalton Campbell had plenty of messengers, a whole army of them, it seemed.
Sir?
You did well. I'd like you to be one of my messengers.
Me, sir?
The work is easier than kitchen work, and the job, unlike kitchen work, pays a wage in addition to food and living quarters. Earning a wage, you could begin to set money aside for your future. Perhaps one day, when you earn your surname, you might be able to buy yourself something, perhaps a sword. Fitch stood frozen, his mind focused intently on Dalton Campbell's words, running them through his head again. He never even dreamed such dreams as working as a messenger. He'd not considered the possibility of work that would give him more than a roof and food, the opportunity to lift some good liquor, and perhaps a penny bonus now and again. Of course, he dreamed of having a sword and reading and other things, but those were silly dreams, and he knew it. They were just for fun dreaming, daydreaming. He hadn't dared dream close to real things such as this, such as actually being a messenger.
Well, what do you say, Fitch? Would you like to be one of my messengers?
Naturally, you couldn't wear those clothes. You would have to wear messenger livery. Dalton Campbell leaned forward to look over the desk and down. That includes boots. You would have to wear boots to be a messenger. You would have to move to new quarters, too. The messengers have quarters together. Beds, not pallets. The beds have sheets. You have to make up your bed, of course, and keep your own trunk in order, but the staff washes the messenger's clothes and bedding.
What do you say, Fitch? Would you like to join my staff of messengers?
Fitch swallowed.
What about Morley? Asked Campbell. Morley did just as you said, too. Would he become a messenger with me?
The leather squeaked when Dalton Campbell again tipped back onto the two rear legs of his chair. He sucked on the end of the spiraled blue and clear glass pen for a time as he studied Fitch's eyes. At last he took the pen away from his mouth.
I only need one messenger right now. It's time you started thinking about yourself, Fitch, about your future. Do you want to be a kitchen boy the rest of your life? The time has come for you to do what's right for you, Fitch, if you ever want to get places in life. This is your chance to rise up out of that kitchen. It may be the only chance you get. I'm offering the position to you, not Morley. Take it or leave it. What's it going to be, then?
Fitch licked his lips.
Well, sir, I like Morley. He's my friend. But I don't think there's anything I'd rather do in the whole world than be your messenger, Master Campbell. I'll take the job if you'll have me.
Good. Welcome to the staff, then, Fitch.
He smiled in a friendly way.
Your loyalty to your friend is admirable. I hope you feel the same of this office. I will have a part-time position for Morley for now, and I suspect that at some point in the future a position may open up, and he could then join you on the messenger staff.
Fitch felt relief at that news. He'd hate to lose his friend, but he would do anything to get out of Master Drummond's kitchen and to be a messenger.
That's awfully kind of you, sir. I know Morley will do right by you, too. I swear I will.
Dalton Campbell leaned forward again, letting the front legs of the chair thunk down.
All right, then. He slid a folded paper across the desk. Take this down to Master Drummond. It informs him that I have engaged your services as a messenger, and you are no longer responsible to him. I thought you might like to deliver it yourself as your first official message.
Fitch wanted to jump up and hoot a cheer, but he instead remained emotionless, as he thought a messenger would.
Yes, sir, I would.
He realized he was standing up straighter, too.
Right after, then one of my other messengers, Rowley, will take you down to Estate Supply. They will provide you with livery that fits close enough for the time being.
When you're down there, the seamstress will measure you up so your new clothes can be fitted to you. While in my service, I expect all my messengers to be smartly dressed in tailored livery. I expect my messengers to reflect well on my office. That means you and your clothes are to be clean, your boots polished, your hair brushed, and you will conduct yourself properly at all times. Rowley will explain the details to you. Can you do all that, Fitch? Fitch's knees trembled.
Yes, sir, I surely can, sir.
Thinking about the new clothes he would be wearing, he suddenly felt very ashamed of what had to be his filthy, scruffy look. An hour ago, he thought he looked just fine as he was, but no longer. He couldn't wait to get out of his scullion rags. He wondered what Beata would think when she saw him in his handsome new messenger's livery. Dalton Campbell slid a leather pouch across the desk. The flap was secured with a large dribbling of amber wax, impressed with a sheaf of wheat seal design. After you clean up and get on your new outfit, I want you to deliver this pouch to the Office of Cultural Amity in Fairfield. Do you know where it is?
Yes, sir, Master Campbell. I grew up in Fairfield, and I know just about any place there.
So I was told. We have messengers from all over Andrith, and they mostly cover the places they know, places where they grew up. Since you know Fairfield, you will be assigned to that area for most of your work. Dalton Campbell leaned back to fish something from a pocket. This is for you. He flipped it through the air. Fitch caught it and stared dumbly at the silver sovereign in his palm. He expected that most rich folk didn't even carry such a huge sum about.
But, sir, I haven't worked the month yet.
This is not your messenger's wage. You get your wage at the end of every month. Dalton Campbell lifted an eyebrow. This is to show my appreciation for the job you did last night. Claudine Winthrop. That was what he meant, scaring Claudine Winthrop into keeping quiet. She had called Fitch, sir. Fitch laid the silver coin on the desk. With a finger, he reluctantly slid the coin a few inches toward Dalton Campbell.
Master Campbell, you owe me nothing for that. You never promised me anything for it. I did it because I wanted to help you and to protect the future sovereign, not for a reward. I can't take money I'm not owed.
The aide smiled to himself. Take the coin, Fitch. That's an order. After you deliver that pouch in Fairfield, I don't have anything else for you today. So I want you to spend some of that, all of it, if you wish, on yourself. Have some fun. Buy candy or buy yourself a drink. It's your money. Spend it as you wish. Fitch swallowed back his excitement.
Yes, sir. Thank you, sir. I'll do as you say, then.
Good. Just one thing, though. Campbell put an elbow on the desk and leaned forward. Don't spend it on prostitutes in the city. There are some very nasty diseases going through the whores in Fairfield this spring. It's an unpleasant way to die. If you go to the wrong prostitute, you will not live long enough to be a good messenger. While the idea of being with a woman was achingly tantalizing, Fitch didn't see how he would ever work up the nerve to go through with it and get naked in front of one. He liked looking at women the way he liked looking at Claudine Winthrop, and he liked looking at Beata, and he liked imagining them naked, but he never imagined them seeing him naked in an aroused state. He had enough trouble hiding his aroused condition from women when he had his clothes on. He ached to be with a woman. Couldn't figure how the embarrassment of the situation wouldn't ruin the lust of it. Maybe if it was a girl he knew and liked, and he kissed and cuddled and courted her for a period of time, came to know her well, he might see how he could get to the point of the procedure, but he couldn't imagine how anyone ever worked up the nerve to go to a woman you didn't even know and just strip naked right in front of her. Maybe if it was dark, maybe that was it. Maybe it was dark in the prostitute's rooms, so the two people wouldn't actually see each other. But he still...
Fitch?
Fitch cleared his throat.
No, sir. I swear an oath not to go to any of the prostitutes in Fairfield. No, sir, I won't.
Chapter 24 After the boy left, Dalton yawned. He had been up long before dawn, calling in staff, meeting with trusted assistants, to hear their reports of any relevant discussions at the feast, and then seeing about the preparation of all the messages. The staff employed in the copying and preparation of messages, among other things, took up the next six rooms down the hall, but they had needed his outer offices to complete the task in such short order. By first light, Dalton had his messengers off to the criers in every corner of Andorath. Later, when the minister was up and had finished with whoever had ended up as his bed partner, Dalton would let the man know the wording of the statement, so he might not be taken by surprise, seeing as how he was the signatory to the announcement. The criers would read the messages in meeting halls, guild halls, merchant and trade halls, town and city council halls, taverns, inns, every army post, every university, every worship service, every penance assembly, every fulling, paper and grain mill, every market square, anywhere people gathered, from one end of Andorath to the other. Within a matter of days, the message, the exact message as Dalton had written it, would be in every ear. Criers who didn't read the messages exactly as written were sooner or later reported and replaced with men more interested in keeping their source of extra income. Besides sending the messages to the criers, Dalton, on a rotating basis, sent identical messages to people about the land who earned a bit of extra money by listening to the crier and reporting if the message was altered, all part of tending his cobweb. Few people understood, as did Dalton, the importance of a precisely tailored, cogent-sounding, uniform message reaching every ear. Few people understood the power wielded by the one controlling the words people heard. What people heard, if put to them properly, they believed, regardless of what were those words. Few people understood the weapon that was a properly fashioned twist of information. Now there was a new law in the land, law forbidding partial hiring practices in the mason profession, and ordering the hiring of willing workers who presented themselves for work. The day before, such action against a powerful guild would have been unthinkable. His messages chided people to act by the highest Ander cultural ideals, and not to take understandably belligerent action against masons for their past despicable practices of being a party to children starving. Instead, his message insisted that they follow the new, higher standards of the Winthrop Fair Employment Law, and the startled masons, rather than attacking the new law, would be busily and vigorously trying to prove that they were not intentionally starving the children of their neighbors. Before long, masons across the land would not only comply, but embrace the new law as if they themselves had all along been urging its passage. It was either that or be stoned by angry mobs. Dalton liked to consider every eventuality and have the road laid before the cart arrived. By the time Rowley got Fitch cleaned up and into messenger livery, and the boy off on his way with the law pouch, it would be too late for the Office of Cultural Amity if, for some reason, the 11 directors changed their minds to do anything about it. The criers would already be proclaiming the new law all over Fairfield, and soon it would be known far and wide. None of the 11 directors would now be able to alter their show of hands at the feast. Fitch would fit right in with the rest of Dalton's messengers. They were all men he had collected over the previous 10 years, young men pulled from obscure places, otherwise doomed to a life of hard labor, degradation, few options, and little hope. They were the dirt under the heels of Andorath culture. Now, through the delivery of messages to criers, they helped shape and control Andorath culture. The messengers did more than merely deliver messages. In some ways, they were almost a private army, paid for by the public, and one of the means by which Dalton had risen to his present post. All his messengers were unshakably loyal to no one but Dalton. Most would willingly go to their death if he requested it. There had been occasions when he had. Dalton smiled as his thoughts wandered to more pleasant things, wandered to Teresa. She was floating on air from having been introduced to the sovereign. When they had returned to their apartments after the feast and retired to bed, as she had promised, she had soundly rewarded him with just how good she could be. And Teresa could be extraordinarily good. She had been so inspired by the experience of meeting the sovereign that she was spending the morning in prayer. He doubted she could have been more moved had she met the Creator himself. Dalton was pleased that he could provide Teresa such an exalting experience. At least she had not fainted, as had several women and one man when they were presented to the sovereign. Were it not a common occurrence, it would have been embarrassing for those people. As it was, everyone understood and readily accepted their reaction. In some ways, it was a mark of distinction, a talisman of faith, proving one's devotion to the Creator. No one considered it anything but sincere faith laid bare. Dalton, however, recognized the Sovereign as the man he was, a man in a high office, but a man nonetheless. For some people, though, he transcended such worldly notions. When Bertrand Chanbour, a man already widely respected and admired as the most outstanding minister of culture ever to serve, became Sovereign, he too would become the object of mindless adoration. Dalton suspected, though, that a great many of the swooning women would be endeavoring to fall under him rather than faint before him. To many it would be a religious experience beyond the mere coupling with a man of power such as the Minister of Culture. Even husbands would be ennobled by their wives' holy acceptance into such congress with a Sovereign. When he heard a knock at the door, Dalton looked up and began to say, "Enter," but the woman was already barging in. It was Franca Gowanlock. Dalton rose. "Ah, Franca, how good to see you. Did you enjoy the feast?" For some reason, the woman had a dark look. Added to her dark eyes and hair and the general aspect which made her seem as if she were somehow always standing in a shadow even when she wasn't, that made the look very dark indeed. The air always seemed still and cool whenever Franca was about. She snatched the top rail of a chair on her way past, dragging it along to his desk. She set the chair before the desk, plopped herself down in front of him, and folded her arms. Somewhat taken aback, Dalton sank back into his chair. Fine lines splayed out from her squinted eyes. "I don't like that one from the Order. Stein, I don't like him one bit." Dalton relaxed back into his chair. Franca wore her black, nearly shoulder-length hair loose, yet it swept back somewhat from her face, as if it had been frozen stiff by an icy wind. A bit of gray streaked her temples, but rather than adding years to her looks, it added only to her serious mien. Her simple sienna dress buttoned to her neck. A little higher up, a band of black velvet hugged her throat. It was usually black velvet, but not always. Whatever it was made from, it was always at least 2 fingers wide. Because she had always wore a throat band, Dalton wondered all the more why and what, if anything, might be under it. Franca being Franca, he never asked. He had known Franca Gowanlock for nearly 15 years, and had employed her talents for well over half that time. He had sometimes mused to himself that she must have once been beheaded and sewn her own head back on. "I am sorry, Franca. Did he do something to you, insult you? He didn't lay a hand to you, did he? I will have him dealt with, if that's the case. You have my word." Franca knew his word to her was beyond reproach. She twined her long, graceful fingers together in her lap. "He had enough women willing and eager. He didn't need me for that." Dalton, truly at a loss, but cautious nonetheless, spread his hands. "Then what is it?" Franca put her forearms on the desk and tipped her head in. She lowered her voice. "He did something with my gift. He scrambled it all up or something." Dalton blinked, true concern roiling through him. "You mean you think the man has some kind of magical power, that he cast a spell or something?" "I don't know," Franca growled, "but he did something." "How do you know?" "I tried to listen to conversations at the feast, just like I always do. I tell you, Dalton, I wouldn't know I had the gift if I didn't know I did. Nothing. I got nothing from no one, not a thing." Dalton's frown now mimicked hers. "You mean that your gift didn't help you overhear anything? Don't you hear anything? Isn't that what I just said?" Dalton drummed his fingers on the table. He turned and peered out the window. He got up and lifted the sash, letting in the warm breeze. He motioned to Franca, and she came around the desk. Dalton pointed to 2 men engaged in conversation under a tree across the lawn. "Down there, those two. Tell me what they're saying." Franca put her hands on the sill and leaned out a little, staring at the 2 men. The sun on her face showed how time truly was beginning to wrinkle, stretch, and sag what he had always thought was one of the most beautiful, if not the strangest, women he had ever known. Even so, despite the advance of time, her beauty was still haunting.